Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 6. We will entitle this chapter, Job Replies, My Complaint is Just. Our context is this. In the previous two chapters, chapters 4 and 5, Job's false friend Eliphaz has spent two entire chapters haranguing Job, telling him, look, the innocent prosper, and you're not prospering, therefore you're not innocent. So come clean, Job. Confess your sin. So we start now in Job 6, verses 1 through 3. Then Job answered, oh, that my grief were actually weighed and laid in the balances together with my calamity. For then it would be heavier than the sand of the seas. Therefore my words have been rash. Now verse 1 says, Job answered. This was after a long time of listening to two chapters of garbage being dumped on him without saying a word in reply. He was quite patient, listening to Eliphaz ream him out. And then Job says, look, you can take balances. On one side, you can put all the sands of the sea. That's pretty heavy. But on the other side, you can put my objective discomforts, my calamities, along with my subjective grief in response to those calamities on the other side of those scales. And guess which wins? Not the sands of the ocean, but my griefs and my calamities. Therefore, my words have been rash. In other words, yeah, I concede to you I've been a little bit querulous and complaining to God about what's happened. But things have been pretty difficult here, Eliphaz. So when Job tells Eliphaz that his words have been rash, other translations have it, my words have been impetuous. The KJV margin has, I want words to express my grief. I lack words, in other words, to express my grief. That's kind of a milquetoast translation. I think it's better to say, as Jameson Fawcett Brown says, the Hebrew is to speak rashly. So Job seems to go along with Eliphaz's idea that it was rash for Job to proclaim his innocence. As the Cambridge commentary says, quote, Job with transparent simplicity concedes a certain extravagance in his language, although he excuses it, starting in verse 4, as we'll see in just a minute. You could say he's excusing it here in chapter 2, because he's saying his grief and calamity was of such weight that that's what provoked him to speak that way. So that's a mitigating circumstance there, Eliphaz. Give me a break. Now, what words that Job has spoken have been rash? He's referring to his complaint in chapter 3, when Job lamented the day that he was born, when he said that his birthday should be cursed, etc. So we move now to Job 6, verses 4 through 7. For the arrows of the Almighty are within me, their poison my spirit drinks. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild donkey bray over his grass, or does the ox low over his fodder? Can something tasteless be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. They are like loathsome food to me. Verse 4, it sounds like Job is getting ready to blame God. The arrows of the Almighty are within me. Was Job right that God was doing this to him? That God's poison arrows were leaching poison into his spirit? Well, Job was partially right. God allowed it, even though he didn't directly cause it. But Job doesn't say God doesn't have the right to do that. He's just saying this is what's happened, and this is why I'm speaking a little bit rashly or impetuously. Of course, this poison arrow, or these poison arrows that Job is referring to, refers to the practice that warriors would dip their arrows in poison in order to kill their enemies. That, of course, has taken place over a lot of different historical context. Now, verse 5 is a little bit strange at first. Does the wild donkey bray over his grass? Here's a couple of options over what that means. This first option is from the NIV Study Bible. If someone would give Job the true reason for his misery, he would quit complaining. In other words, a wild donkey brays because he doesn't have grass to eat, and so he complains. Well, if you give him grass, he'll stop complaining. So Job is saying, hey, if you'll just tell me why I'm going through this, I'll stop complaining. Or maybe, as Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggest, he doesn't want an explanation to make him stop braying, speaking impetuously. He wants relief from his suffering, and then he would stop praying. That's a similar option. Verse 6, Job says, can something tasteless be eaten without salt? What he's referring to, Job is that his life now has no spice in it. He's had trouble dealing with it, just like it's hard to eat food with not salt, it's hard to live his life with no pleasure. So once again, Job is saying, look, Eliphaz, it is not surprising that I am complaining about my lot in life. You would complain if you had to eat food without salt. Salt was especially valuable to nomads in the East. Their food, like most ancient people's food, was insipid, consisted of mostly vegetables, with no salt. Now, we take salt for granted. I just saw an academic book, an historical book, entitled Salt. That was the name of it, by a professor, talking about how the desire for salt has moved nations and military troops and tribes and economies. It's an important thing. And of course, Job would have been wealthy. He would have had salt. Then he says, there's of any taste in the white of an egg. The NIV note says, the meaning of the Hebrew for this phrase is uncertain. Here's some other options. Spittle, which resembles the white of an egg. Or is there any taste in spit? Or any taste in spittle? The NASB note says, perhaps it's the juice of a plant. Or is there any taste in the white juice of a plant? Doesn't matter what the metaphor is supposed to be. The meaning is clear. There's no taste in the white of an egg, or there's no taste in spit. There's no taste in the white juice of a plant, just like my life has no taste. Verse 7, Job says, my soul refuses to touch them. Touch what? The salt is food and the white of the egg. They are like loathsome food to me. There's no joy in life anymore, nothing for him to grab. We go now to Job 6, verses 8 through 10. If only my request would be granted and God would provide what I hope for, that he would decide to crush me, to unleash his power and cut me off, it would still bring me comfort, and I would leap for joy in unrelenting pain that I have not denied the words of the Holy One. Now here Job just wants the trial to be over. Look, God, just kill me. I won't deny you. Kill me. Take me to be with you, and I won't have to put up with this horrible trial anymore. How many times have we felt like that? Job wanted to die. He was so miserable. Now note, Job could have committed suicide at any time, but he didn't even consider it. Compare that to the thanatoptic ideals of the modern age, where people openly talk about physician-assisted suicide. Let's kill 60, 70 million human beings through abortion, and the suicide rate is just horrible. Job didn't even think about it. He just wanted God to do it for him, to unleash his power. As Clark says, to let loose an arrow to kill me, to cut me off. That's a metaphor from a weaver cutting off the web from a loom, like Job being cut loose from life. And then Job said, even though I had unrelenting pain, I would still leap for joy because I hadn't denied the words of the Holy One, which of course is driving Job through all this, is I will not deny God. You keep telling me, my wife has told me I need to curse God and die, and my three friends are telling me that God is angry at me. I'm not going to deny God. I'm not going to blame God on anything. I'm going to hold fast to my integrity. We go now to Job 6, 11 through 14. What strength do I have that I should continue to hope? Job continues. What is my future that I should be patient? Is my strength that of stone or my flesh made of bronze? Since I cannot help myself, the hope for success has been banished from me. A despairing man should receive loyalty from his friends even if he abandons the fear of the Almighty. So in verse 11, Job contradicts Eliphaz's offer of hope. Eliphaz in Job chapter 5, verse 11 says this, so that he, that's Yahweh, sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He's trying to say, look, Job, there's hope if you'll just confess your sin. And Job replies in verse 11, I don't have any hope. What is my future? I don't have any hope. What strength do I have to have hope? I don't have enough strength to hope. I don't have the strength of stone. And my flesh is not made of bronze, because that's what it would take for me to have hope, and I'm too weak for that. What is my future, Job says. He had no children left to take care of him, even if he did recover from his sickness. And so Job is saying, what's the point of waiting for God to set the lowly Job on high, as Eliphaz says? Oh, he sits on high those who are lowly. How am I ever going to be set on high again? I don't have any children. I don't have any future. Not only that, no one would heed Job's wise counsel anymore. He used to be well respected among his community. Nobody's going to pay any attention to him because they assumed he had grievously sinned. His life is over. Over, folks. This reminds me of a very good friend of mine who called me one day. He had had a legal setback, business setback. He was losing his business, and he really was in a bad way. And I was giving him the standard advice, and I referred to Job. And my friend said, Job doesn't have anything on me. So he thought he was worse off than Job, which he was not, but he thought he was. There is nothing worse to be in despair, folks. Nothing. And Job is in despair here. Verse 13, Job says, since I cannot help myself, the hope for success has been banished from me. No more hope. The NIV translates that as a question by saying, do I have any power to help myself now that success has been driven from me? So the Holman Christian Study Bible makes it a statement that's imperative. The NIV makes it interrogative, and Adam Clark makes it exclamatory. There's no help in me, and deliverance is quite driven from me. Some people say that Job is so hopeless here that Job's reason has been driven away. That's why he can't help himself. No, I don't think so. I don't think he's going crazy yet. I would have been, but he seems to be still sane. And then in verse 14, Job says, a despairing man should receive loyalty from his friends, even if he abandons the fear of the Almighty. Now, there are different ways that this can be translated. Let's just take it the Holman Christian Study Bible way here, the verse I just read. A despairing man should receive loyalty from his friends, even if he abandons the fear of the Almighty. And so what Job is saying, look, conceding that I have disrespected God and I don't fear him anymore, that's what you're saying, Eliphaz, but even conceding that, you ought to be more friendly to me than you've been. You should be more loyal to me. Given the state of my despair, you shouldn't be so darn hard on me. And boy, Eliphaz was hard on Job. But that's a concession, even if I abandon the fear of the Almighty, which I have not done. Job never did that. So, a fortiori, I should receive loyalty from my friends. If I had abandoned the fear of the Almighty, I should receive loyalty from my friends. And even more so, if I have not abandoned the fear of the Almighty, I should receive loyalty from my friends. But I'm not getting it. So let's look at three ways to translate that verse. The NIV has the same as the Holman Christian Study Bible. A despairing man should receive loyalty from his friends even though he abandons the fear of the Almighty. And I've just explained that option. But here's another option. This is the KJV. To him that is afflicted, pity should be showed from his friend, but he forsaketh the fear of the Almighty. And the King James has it that Eliphaz is forsaking the fear of the Almighty, not Job. In other words, Eliphaz, you are forsaking the fear of God by your lousy attitude toward me. Because you are not showing loyalty to me, you have abandoned the fear of the Almighty. Now, here's the NASB translation for a third way to translate it. For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend so that he does not forsake the fear of the Almighty. Now, in this translation, the loyalty of Eliphaz and friends will keep Job from forsaking God. Well, I don't think there's any way to really settle that issue, and we come up with slightly different meanings. I like the Holman Christian Study Bible and the NIV translation. Eliphaz, you should be with me, even though I have abandoned the fear of the Almighty, which I haven't. We go now to Job 6, 15 through 17. My brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi. This is Job continuing to speak. Like the torrents of wadis which vanish, which are turbid because of ice into which the snow melts. When they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. Now, wadi, as the NIV translates, is an intermittent stream. I remember on a tour with a Yemeni Jew driving my wife and me in a car through the desert of Zin, the wilderness of Zin, Z-I-N. And he was claiming that Moses had come through the wadis there onto this plain. Of course, he doesn't know that. Tour guides know everything. The scholars don't know exactly the route of the Exodus. But he said that if the Israelites had been walking down one of those wadis, coming out of the mountains into the plain. Now, when I say mountains, they're these big red rocks, copper-looking, desolate-looking mountains. There's not a blade of grass anywhere. And because there's no grass, as soon as it rains, the water collects in those little wadis. It comes pouring down, and then it gets hot. The water sinks into the ground, and the water disappears. And the tour guide was saying that if the Israelites had been caught in one of those wadis and it started to rain in a flash thunderstorm, the flash flood would have killed them all. So this is a great metaphor here. Job is saying, just like a wadi is there with torrents of water, all of a sudden those torrents of water disappear. just like your friendship. Oh, yeah, you come running to me with all your friendship, but as soon as things get bad, and as soon as I don't do what you want me to do and confess to a sin that I didn't commit, your friendship disappears like the water of a wadi. A wadi is turbid because of ice and into which the snow melts, because in the wintertime, there's snow on the top of those mountains, and then as it gets warmer and warmer, the snow melts and pours into the wadi, and that's where the wadi gets its water from. But then, of course, as time goes on, the water disappears. Verse 17, when they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. As John Gill puts it, Eliphaz and friends looked big and promised long and lasting friendship, but proved in time of adversity unfaithful and deceitful. And so it denotes the fickleness and inconstancy of their friendship. We go now to Job 6, verses 18 through 21. Caravans turn away from their routes, go up into the desert, and perish. The caravans of Tema look for these streams. The traveling merchants of Sheba hope for them. They are ashamed because they have been confident of finding water. When they arrive there, they are frustrated. So this is what you have now become to me. When you see something dreadful, you are afraid. Now there's a translation issue here in verse 18. Caravans turn away from their routes. The NASB makes that word there, instead of being caravans, the wadis that we just talked about in the previous three verses. The NASB makes it be the wadis that are turning away from their routes. KJV has it that way too. The NIV agrees with the Holman Christian Study Bible and has caravans. Let's just take it as caravans. They turn away from their routes, they go up into the desert, and perish. In other words, they're traveling, and they're looking for water. And so they leave their route to head for the streams. Water's not there. They were so confident of finding water, and now they're frustrated because the water's not there. And Job is saying, that's what I feel like from you. I'm looking for friendship from you. I'm looking for comfort from you. And I am totally frustrated because I'm not getting it, just like those caravans aren't getting water in the desert. I'm in the desert, I need water, and you're not providing it to me. And then Job finishes off by saying this, when you see something dreadful, you are afraid. A couple of options as to what they would be afraid of. Perhaps they're afraid of the righteous judgments of God, afraid that judgments like Job's might fall on them too, should they condone Job and his alleged sin of not confessing what he had done wrong. And so they're afraid. They're saying, oh my gosh, what's happened to Job? I'm afraid of what's going to happen to him further. He's going to die if he doesn't confess. Or what if I've committed some kind of sin? I could end up as bad as Job has. It could be more simply that Eliphaz and friends look at Job's terrible appearance and become afraid. And that's what Job's referring to. I look like a monster now, and you're afraid of what's happened to me. A couple little minor points here. Verse 19 says, the caravans of Tema look for the wadis. Tema was a famous oasis. BibleAtlas.org has it just east of the Gulf of Aqaba, just south of the northern tip of Aqaba in the Arabian desert there. It was named after a son of Ishmael, Genesis 25:15. It's mentioned in other scriptures, Isaiah 21:14, bring water for the thirsty, O inhabitants of the land of Tema. Meet the fugitive with bread. It was an oasis. Bring water for the thirsty. Jeremiah 25:23 mentions Dedan, D-E-D-A-N, and I hope I pronounced that right, Tema and Buz. Dedan's on the map right close to Tema, right east of the Gulf of Aqaba, down a little bit from the northern tip. So that's Tema, and then Job mentions the traveling merchants of Sheba hope for these wadis of water. Sheba, of course, is famous because of the Queen of Sheba. It's probably in southern Arabia. Nobody knows where it is. I always think Sheba, I think southwestern corner of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula in present-day Yemen, because that's as good a place as any. But it's down there in the south of Arabia somewhere. Here's some other scriptures where Sheba is mentioned. Ezekiel 27:22. The traders of Sheba and Ramah, they traded with you. They paid for your wares with the best of all kinds of spices and with all kinds of precious stones and gold. So Sheba was not an isolated desert oasis. It was a place of wealth and trade. Jeremiah 6:20. For what purpose does frankincense come to me from Sheba and the sweet cane from a distant land? Your burnt offerings are not acceptable. So frankincense came from Sheba. And then, of course, the famous passage in Matthew 12:42, the Queen of the South, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and Easton's assumed that the Queen of the South is the Queen of Sheba. The Queen of the South will rise up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here. Sheba is also mentioned in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10. So Teman and Sheba are well known to nomads who live in the desert, well known to Job. We go now to Job 6, verses 22 and 23. Job continues, "Have I said, give me something, or offer a bribe for me from your wealth, or deliver me from the hand of the adversary, or redeem me from the hand of the tyrants?" Job is making a point here. He's not asked for a bit of help from his friends. He just wants some friendship, but they haven't given it to him. And to make their lack even more culpable, he's not even asked them for money to help him in his hard times. As John Gill says, since Job had been so kind not to ask for money, they should have reciprocated his kindness. Often when men hit hard times, they ask for charity. And when they do, potential givers come up with all kinds of excuses not to give. Oh, you're lazy. That's why you're poor. You brought it on yourselves. And this idea of Job bringing it on himself is exactly what Eliphaz is saying. Job, you sinned. So if Job had asked for money, they would have said, "Now, Job, we're not going to give you any money because this is your own fault." Now, at the end of verse 22, Job says, "Offer a bribe for me." That's the New American Standard Bible. Other translations have it. Ransom, the NIV. "Offer a ransom for me." KJV has "a reward for me." Bribe seems sort of a strange translation. A bribe means you're getting a government official to do something with money, to do something for you by giving them money. And I don't see what that's got to do with the situation here. So I'm just going to take it. Job is saying, "You haven't given me any money from your wealth." That's the easiest way to look at it. You could make an effort to redeem that translation, offer a bribe from your wealth in order to get Job acquitted in the court of public opinion. "Give me some money to show that I'm not guilty so that people will look at me as innocent," to bribe public opinion. Or how about bribe God? "Give me some money to redeem me from my punishment from God. So give me a bribe for that." I think that's kind of a stretch, really. But at any rate, Job did not ask for money. He then said, "I didn't ask you to deliver me from the hand of the adversary either." What adversary might he be talking about? He also says, "Redeem. I didn't ask you to redeem me from the hand of the tyrants." What adversaries? What tyrants? Well, here's some options. Gill and Clark suggest the Sabaeans and Chaldeans in chapter 1 who had stolen his cattle. Job says, "I didn't ask you to go help me chase these guys down to get my cattle back." The Sabaeans stole his cattle, oxen, and donkeys, and the Chaldeans stole his camels. But he didn't ask for help to go get them back. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggests that he refused to ask Eliphaz to redeem him from his creditors, which I think is somewhat of a stretch. We go down to Job, chapter 6, verses 24 through 27. Job continues, "Teach me, and I will be silent. Help me understand what I did wrong. How painful honest words can be. But what did your rebuke prove? Do you think that you can disprove my words, or that a despairing man's words are mere wind? No doubt you would cast lots for a fatherless child and negotiate a price to sell your friend." Ooh. I hope these people were friends after all this is over with, because they sure are speaking bluntly to each other. Now in verse 24, when Job says, "Teach me and I will be silent," Job might be being sarcastic there, as the NIV Study Bible and Jameson, Fawcett, Brown suggest. But on the other hand, as John Gill and Adam Clark suggest, Job was showing that he was open, honest, open to conviction. Well, I think the latter is true. I don't think he's being sarcastic here. It's hard to say, but this brings up an application point here. One holding to a strong principle under severe stress should always ask this: am I wrong? I'm holding on to this. A lot of bad stuff has happened. I'm receiving persecution because of this. Maybe my views are wrong. Nothing wrong with asking that. In fact, I think you should ask that. Job says, "Teach me," in verse 24, "and I will be silent." What does he mean by silent? Well, he could be saying, "Teach me and I will not interrupt you while you're teaching me." He could also be saying, "Teach me, and I'll let you finish, and I will make no more arguments after you've finished. Help me understand what I did wrong. Prove it to me." Job says in verse 25, "How painful honest words can be." Now, it's not clear whose honest words are painful. It could be that Job is saying, you, Eliphaz, and your friends, your words are very painful to me, but they're honest, and I can take the pain. Or it could be that Job is saying that my words are painful and honest, and so you need to listen to what I say, even though they are painful and honest. My take on that is probably Eliphaz's words that are painful and honest that Job is referring to here. At any rate, Job says, you haven't proved a thing with your two chapters of diatribe against me. Your rebuke hasn't proven a thing. And he says, do you think you could disprove my words, or that a despairing man's words are mere wind? In other words, just because I'm in trouble here, do you think my words just go up into there and float off into nothingness like they don't have any weight? My words don't have any force or reasoning behind them. They're like a puff of wind that goes floating off into the atmosphere? No, my words are weightier than that. And then the zinger in verse 27, Job says, no doubt you, Eliphaz, you would cast lots for a fatherless child and negotiate a price to sell your friend. Now, what does that mean, to cast lots? NIV Study Bible says that Job is meaning here that Eliphaz would collect debts by making slaves out of orphans. The Cambridge commentator says that after the death of a father, the creditors would cast lots to see who would get the remaining orphan as a slave. In other words, instead of supporting the poor orphan with charity, you would compete with other creditors, cast lots to see who gets the orphan for a slave. You would negotiate a price to sell your friend. Your friend owes you money, so instead of forgiving the debt, you say, well, I'm going to sell you into slavery so you'll pay the debt. You usually don't do that with friends, maybe in an arm's length commercial transactions, but not with friends. So Job lets him hold it. Job lets Eliphaz take it right between the eyes. So we go now to Job 6, verses 28 through 30. Job continues, but now please look at me. Would I lie to your face? Reconsider. Don't be unjust. Reconsider. My righteousness is still the issue. Is there injustice on my tongue, or can my palate not taste disaster? So Job in verse 28 says, please look at me. Would I lie to you? Job is showing absolute confidence in the justice of his cause, because it's hard to maintain a lie of such magnitude. I didn't sin. I didn't sin. It's impossible to maintain such a lie without it showing on one's face. The guilt's going to show up sooner or later. As John Gill says, quote, see if you can find any traces of fear and falsehood, of dishonesty and hypocrisy, of shame and blushing, and observe if there is not all the appearance of an honest mind, of a good conscience within, that has nothing to fear from the strictest examination. Job's putting up quite a defense. I've got to hand it to him. He's doing a great job. Reconsider. In other words, think again what you spent two chapters blasting me with, Eliphaz. You're unjust if you don't reconsider. My righteousness is still the issue. Then I mean, note has it as my righteousness still stands is what it means. The NIV translation has my integrity is at stake. Job defends himself all the way through here, saying, I did not sin in such a way as to cause all this grief that came upon me. Job says in verse 30, is there injustice on my tongue? Again, he's referring back to when he cursed the day he was born. Job 3, verse 1. After this, Job began to speak and cursed the day he was born. Then the whole chapter 3 is sentiments along that line. Job saying, hey, that's no injustice on my tongue for complaining about the day I was born. I'm miserable, but I didn't do anything to cause this. And then Job finishes up with a strange expression. Can my palate not taste disaster? The KJV has there, cannot my taste discern perverse things? The NIV has, can my mouth not discern malice? What does he mean by that? Well, here's option one. Job's sense and reason could discern that his calamities had not come because of his sin. Job should not be treated like a madman or a fool. In the same way that one's taste buds can discern nasty food, Job's sense and reason can discern that his calamities had not come because of his sin. So when he says, can my palate not taste disaster, what he's saying is, look, if I'd have sinned, that would have created a bad taste in my mouth, and that taste in the mouth is analogous to all the calamities that came upon me. So if I'd have sinned, my palate would have understood that. My moral being would have understood that I've sinned and I'm being punished for it. But my palate doesn't taste disaster. my palate doesn't taste anything coming because of my sin. Well, that's one way you can look at that strange expression. Another way you can say, interpret this, one could say that Job's sense and reason could discern that his friend's arguments were bogus. Is there injustice on my tongue? Or, can't my taste buds taste this crappy food that you're putting in my mouth? I like that because it's easier to understand. I can understand. I can taste lousy moral arguments, Eliphaz, and you're feeding me one right now. Ladies and gentlemen, with that pitiful plea of Job, chapter 6 is finished. We are now ready to go in our next audio to chapter 7, verses 1 through 21. We will continue Job's speech and call chapter 7, Job Continues, My Life Has No Hope. Oh, that sounds cheerful. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.